If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Dave Musgrave, editor of BBC History Magazine. Welcome to our new weekly podcast. You're listening to July 2011, Part 3. BBC History Magazine is, of course, Britain's best-selling history magazine, on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit our website, historyextra.com, for more information, or follow us at twitter.com/BBC History Mag or facebook.com/BBC History Magazine. Coming up this week, we have a tale of two Henrys.
In terms of setting the tone and to some extent the agenda for the Tudors who came after him, I think his achievements are very substantial.
That was Stephen Gunn on King Henry VII.
Wherever I go, I have to start off by saying, who was Henry III? And I often used to place him by saying, well, he's the son of King John, because everyone's heard of King John.
And that was David Carpenter on King Henry III. So the first interview is with Oxford University's Dr. Stephen Gunn. He's going to be telling us all about the reign of Henry VII, who was, of course, the founder of the Tudor dynasty. The August issue of the magazine is a Tudor special where I've invited five historians to argue it out about who was the most important Tudor monarch. And over the course of the next 5 weeks of the podcast, you're going to be hearing my interviews with each of the experts in turn. If you like your Tudor history, you're not alone, and you'll be pleased to know that we've produced a special BBC History Magazine Tudors audiobook, where you can get the full-length interviews that I recorded with all the experts. So you get half an hour each on Kings Henry VII, Henry VIII, Edward VI, and Queens Mary and Elizabeth. We're charging just £1.99 for this, and you can download it via our website at www.historyextra.com/audiobooks/Tudors. Anyway, on with the interview.
You're giving an impression of Henry as a man certainly with a sensitive side. Mm-hmm. What else do do you feel about Henry's character? What sort of a man was he from your research into his life?
It's quite hard to get at Henry's character in some ways, partly because he deliberately played his cards very close to his chest. I think having been in exile from the time he was a young teenager, and indeed for half his life before he became king, he was very good at not letting people know exactly what he was thinking. It's made worse by the fact that much of the description of Henry, much of the more detailed account of what was happening in his reign, actually comes from the last years of the reign, where he's clearly very personally troubled. He's lost his eldest son, he's lost his wife, he's worried about whether he can survive long enough, because he is regularly ill, whether he can survive long enough to get his teenage son, Henry VIII, who is not yet 18 at the point where Henry VII dies, whether he can get him old enough to succeed as a credibly adult ruler. Mm. And so it's not surprising that people talk about him often dressing in black and being rather quiet, and indeed being rather withdrawn. It's harder to tell what he was like earlier in his reign, but certainly if you look at account books, which is more or less all we have, and even those in nothing like so much detail as they survive from later in the reign, you can see he buys a lot of very brightly coloured clothes, and very rich clothes, a lot of cloth of gold, and so on. So he knows how to be a magnificent king. He plays tennis. He gambles quite a lot. He shoots crossbows and longbows. He is a very, very keen hunter, which he carries on being right through the reign. So clearly he knew how to enjoy himself as well, but he's still quite an austere figure. And when people praise him, they tend to praise him for his wisdom and his ability to foresee what difficulties were going to come along and provide against them and so on. There's not quite the sense of warmth for him that that you might look for in somebody who was easier to get along with. Right. There's a very striking moment in the funeral sermon that John Fisher, the Bishop of Rochester, preaches for Henry, where he begins with a great oration about Henry's wisdom and his success in all sorts of different areas of government, and so on. And he goes on to talk about Henry's moral seriousness and the way in which he bewailed his sins on his deathbed and so on. But he does say at one point, "Ah, King Henry, King Henry, if thou wert alive, how many that are now here present would pretend full great pity upon thee." And that pretend, this probably doesn't mean quite the same as it means now, but it still implies that there are a lot of people who are not quite as sorry as they might be that Henry was dead, but who were concerned enough to stay on the right side of him while he was still alive, that they would have given the impression they might be quite sorry when he was dead.
Okay. I'll just take you back to a couple of those points. The first thing I was wondering about was the question of the union of the Roses faction, which today we see as incredibly important, and historically we think, well, that's a key moment. Then was it at the time, was it really that significant to people say, oh, thank God he's managed to bring those two sides together by that marriage union?
I think it's significant in the short term because so many of the supporters of Henry VII who put him on the throne, who've been in exile with him in Brittany and in France, they're people who have been very close servants of Edward IV, who rebel against Richard III because they're so outraged at Richard III's taking the throne away from Edward IV's son, Edward V. And so for them, the idea that Edward IV's daughter, Elizabeth of York, will reign together with Henry in a marriage which he swears before them in the cathedral in Brittany that he will undertake if they put him on the throne. That becomes very important, that Henry is not just the best Lancastrian candidate for the throne, which he is, but by this stage, because of deaths amongst the Lancastrian royal family, he's not a terribly convincing Lancastrian candidate. His Lancastrian blood is illegitimate blood. He's descended not from Edward III's first son, the Black Prince, or from his second son, Lionel, Duke of Clarence, but from his third son, John of Gaunt, and not by a legitimate line, but through John of Gaunt's mistress, the Beaufort family, who are subsequently made legitimate, but it's quite a shaky Lancastrian claim.
Yeah.
But putting that best you can get under the circumstances Lancastrian claim together with Elizabeth of York's much stronger Yorkist claim, that does make quite a viable claim to the throne. Now, of course, it may be that for many people, really what they wanted was just a king who was more or less acceptable in dynastic terms. You could reasonably believe they had a right to be king, but who was an effective king and was accepted by everybody as king. And people don't yet talk in late 15th century England about the state. The term the state comes in the late 16th century, but they do already talk about the crown of England, and they talk a lot about the common weal, the commonwealth, the common good. So there is a sense that you might put your loyalty in the crown and in a king who can pursue the common weal, the common good, and you're not too bothered about exactly what his genes are.
Yeah.
And that probably helps Henry. So in that sense, the exact lines of legitimacy don't matter too much. On the other hand, they probably do matter to people, or they're thought to matter to people, in the sense that the Tudors make great play with the Tudor rose as a badge.
Mm.
They don't, interestingly, nobody calls it the Tudor rose at the time, but they do talk about the red rose and the white, and they use it both in pageantry. So when Henry goes to York in his first progress just after winning Bosworth, there's a little play put on with a mechanical red rose and a white rose which intertwine with each other.
Oh, really?
By the time of the 1492 war against France, things being printed on the king's behalf, like the ordinances of war, the regulations for how the armies to behave, they have the Tudor rose, red and white rose, very prominently printed on them. And we know it's the Tudor rose because there are instructions for somebody who wants to get a copy of it decorated for one of his friends, and he explains that the rose is to be painted partly red and partly white, in the way that we're now familiar with. And by the time that Prince Arthur marries Catherine of Aragon in 1501, the streets of London are covered with painted and carved Tudor roses of all sorts. So the fact that that becomes the big visual calling card of the family suggests that they think the union of the roses is a strong argument.
So they didn't call it the Tudor rose. Did it have a name, or was it?
It doesn't really have a name. I think heraldically it's now called the Union Rose. Whether they call it the Union Rose at the time, I'm not sure. But they do talk a lot about the roses, the rose both red and white. There's a song that's sung at the start of Henry VIII's reign in a piece of court pageantry, which goes something like, the rose both red and white in one rose now doth grow. So the idea of the two coming together, that seems to be quite important to them. And Henry VII uses the red rose as his own personal badge.
Right.
So he's making a claim there to be something different from the white rose of York. The Lancastrians hadn't used the red rose much before then. So somebody clearly comes up with the idea that here's a very powerful branding idea. You can put these two together and say those troubles between the red and the white rose are all over now because we've got the two roses together. They hardly ever use the word Tudor either, partly because, well, that's almost slightly embarrassing, because what it points out is the rather lowly Welsh side of Henry's ancestry.
Yeah.
So when Richard III wants to denounce him as a rival, he calls him Henry Tudor, which is clearly meant to point to the fact that he's got this embarrassing Welsh grandfather. So they don't make much play with that.
Right. What would you say were the main achievements of Henry's reign?
I think the main achievement of Henry's reign is stability.
Mm.
And some people would question that by saying that his approach to stability, which is actually just to keep a very tight grip on everybody, is itself a destabilizing approach. That if you had a king who was more relaxed, who was able to give his trust to people more confidently, who was more prepared to say, clearly a great nobleman whose family have always been important in an area is the natural person to look after that area for me, so I'll just let things roll, and if there are difficulties I can intervene, but if not I won't. That's not Henry's style. It's not Henry's style partly because he spent half his life in exile and he certainly doesn't want to get sent into exile again. It's not his style because his personality is clearly quite bent on detail and management and control, and that's just the kind of person he is. It's also not his style because the people in whom he puts his confidence increasingly are not people from the great noble families of the past, although noblemen who are prepared to serve him he's very happy to use and put trust in, so he's not an anti-noble king in that sense. But the people he seems to get along with and think along the same lines as are lawyers, financial administrators, people as the reign comes to its end, like Edmund Dudley, who is the lawyer who writes in the Tower of London under Henry VIII, when he's just been arrested at the end of Henry VII's reign, a book on how to govern England. But just before that, his accounts survive, and you can see that he's discussing with Henry VII what the rights of the crown are. There's a great book called Jura Regalia, The Rights of the Crown, which he borrows from the king and then gives back. So there's a sense that there's a discussion about what power is and how you use it, and how you use it best to keep England under control, going on between Henry and the people closest to him. And in some ways, that's a rather unlovely way to govern, and clearly some of the noblemen at court think it's a very unlovely way to govern, and they don't get along at all well with the people closest to Henry.
Yeah.
Interestingly, many of them don't really have the chance to say that while Henry's still alive, and they then do say it when Henry's dead, and Henry VIII seems to be much more sympathetic to their concerns.
So if I asked you to summarise an assessment of his legacy, what would you say? How would you talk about the impact of his reign?
I think Henry builds the platform that all the things achieved by the later Tudors rest on. So not only is his style of kingship something which sets a lot of the tone for later Tudor kingship, the idea that you should be magnificent as a king, and that's a way of persuading your subjects that you're a great king who's doing a great job, that's not brand new, but Henry does it in a very serious way, builds palaces like Richmond and Greenwich, which will be important sites for later Tudor monarchs to live in. The use of royal ministers who have meritocratic skills, if you like, lawyers, financial administrators, who are from humbler social backgrounds than royal ministers had often been in the past, certainly than lay royal ministers, people who hadn't risen through the church, had been in the past. That again sets a pattern that later Tudor rulers will use. The taking of power over the church, although Henry doesn't do it in the same totalizing way that Henry VIII does, that's still something that's very important both to Henry and to the lawyers around him, who are very keen to assert common law jurisdiction against the jurisdiction of the church courts. And similarly, the ability to project power into Europe, particularly by developing the navy, that's something which Henry gives a big push to and which carries on developing later on. The Tudor Rose we've already talked about, but the fact that the Tudor Rose and the Beaufort Portcullis survive as two of the really significant badges of Tudor monarchy, that again suggests that Henry VII has set them on a particular path which they then carry on following. So I think it's hard to say that there are single enormous achievements that you can point to in Henry VII's reign, but in terms of setting the tone and to some extent the agenda for the Tudors who came after him, I think his achievements are very substantial.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
That was Oxford University's Dr. Stephen Gunn talking about Henry VII. Stephen has published a number of studies of the counsellors and courtiers of Henry VII, and he's completing a book on the subject. He's also principal investigator of a project funded by the Economic and Social Research Council on accidental death and everyday life in 16th century England, which we hope to feature in the pages of BBC History magazine at some point soon. If you want to hear more from Stephen and our other Tudor experts, the link for the special audio book that I mentioned before is historyextra.com/audiobooks/Tudors, and it's being distributed by audiogo.co.uk. The second interview this week is with Professor David Carpenter of King's College London. He's Professor of Medieval History there and also the director of the AHRC-funded Henry III Fine Rolls Project. Henry III was King of England from 1216 to 1272, and the fine rolls are, as David explains, an excellent way to get an insight into this long and important medieval reign. I met up with him on the occasion of the End of Project conference and asked him to tell me more about Henry III and his fine rolls.
So the first question, really, is a simple question. What's a fine roll? And indeed, what's a fine?
And indeed, who is Henry III?
Yes, indeed.
Difficult questions. Well, fines actually are not at all what they are today. Today it's a sort of penalty, isn't it, imposed for a misdemeanor. Yeah. Whereas in the medieval period, a fine was essentially an offer of money to the king for a concession from him or a favour.
Right.
And the fine rolls are simply the rolls on which all these offers of money to the king are recorded.
Okay.
And I suppose because fines, I mean, the king has so much to give, that the fine rolls really do reflect what people wanted from the king and also what he was demanding of you. And so they have a wonderful window into the government, kingship, society of the medieval period.
So they're a key source?
Absolutely key source, particularly the fine rolls of Henry III, because this is a key period between his reign is a key period, 1216, 1272.
Mm. A long reign, isn't it?
Between, on the one hand, the establishment of Magna Carta at the beginning, and on the other, the beginnings of the parliamentary tax-based state at the end. And in a way, the fine rolls, more than any other document, it helps to explain that transition.
Just to be clear, the fine rolls, they're not exclusive to Henry III. They started before him and they carry on.
They first survived from the beginning of John's reign, 1199, but probably they go back much earlier. And golly, I don't know how long they go on for, but certainly into the later Middle Ages and perhaps beyond. But I think the fine rolls of Henry III are by far the most interesting because fines, there's a huge transition in the nature of fines during that period. They're huge, actually. I mean, one particular fine roll for Henry's reign, there's one for every regnal year, mm-hmm. so they run from October to October, and they can have 30,000, 40,000 words on them. And for the reign as a whole, they're nearly 2 million words on the fine rolls.
So let's talk about the physicality of them. Sure. They're actually big pieces of parchment.
Yeah, no, they are amazing pieces of parchment, all treasured up in the National Archives at Kew. And they sort of look like, sort of about, say, a foot by... They're divided into membranes, and each membrane, of course, they're all written in Latin on sheepskin, vellum, and they're divided up into membranes, and one membrane might be a foot wide and 3 feet long, and then they're all sewn together. And so one roll might have about 30 membranes like that. And if you unroll them, they're amazing things. You need a corridor to unroll them all.
So that's the problem with them. That's nice thing about them. They're such amazing things, but the problem with them is they're quite hard to access, which is why you've been doing this project.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The Henry III Fine Rolls Project, its aim is to unlock the treasures of this material
and make them available really to everybody. And so what the project's done, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, is to translate all these roles into English and put this English translation up onto the, to make it freely available on the project's website, which is www.fineroleshenry3.org.uk. So go and have a look.
Okay, so you go to this website and you can see some actual physical expressions of the fine. You can see pictures of some of them.
Yeah, no, there's both the translation, and then you can click from the translation of each membrane to the actual image of the membrane, so you can actually see physically what it looks like too. And that's the unique thing about the project. You've got the translation on the one hand and the image on the other.
So if I'm not an academic historian, why should I go to your website? What would I find that would interest me if I'm not sort of actively trying to research the history of Henry III?
Well, I think you'll find a tremendous amount about places. Mm. So if you're interested in the place you live, the village you live, the town, if you simply put into the search facility, and it's all electronic, you can search it. If you put in, say, Bloxham in Oxfordshire, or if you put in Lewisham in Kent, and you put it into the search facility, you'll find all sorts of references to your village. And you might find, for example, the peasants of the village offering money to the king for protection against their lord, or to have a charter of privileges. The fine rolls have got a huge amount about the struggle of villagers against their lords. So, you know, the villagers of Brampton in Huntingdonshire, Rothley in Leicestershire. And I think that's one of the key and most exciting things which anybody can do. They can find out about the place they live from the fine rolls and see what's going on there in the 13th century, to understand the aspirations of the people living there, who will be offering money to the king for concessions and favours. Or perhaps the lord of the place may be offering money, say to set up a market and fair, or to have a private hunting preserve. All those sorts of things will be on the fine rolls.
Okay. For an academic historian, presumably it's an even greater treasure. What sort of themes have been coming out for you and your colleagues?
Two major themes. The first is the huge expansion of the common law. I mean, this is the period in which the common law really gets going, and that's shown on the fine rolls because more and more people are offering money to the king to begin legal actions, further legal actions, according to all these wonderful new processes of the common law. So, you know, the law, which still in a way we have, a writ-based driven law, is coming into place in the 13th century, and we can see that in the fine rolls. That's one thing. The other theme, actually, is the gigantic decline in the amount of money from fines. Because in John's reign, John charged huge amounts for people to be restored to his favour, for people to inherit land, thousands and thousands of pounds sometimes, whereas Henry III never able to do that. And the reason is Magna Carta. So the fine rolls are a tremendous indication of the post-Magna Carta state, in which the power and the minatory threatening power of kingship has been greatly reduced by the charter. And I think that's one of the key things which has emerged from the actual analysis of the rolls.
So Henry III's hands were tied because Magna Carta had been sealed by his predecessor.
Absolutely
John in 1215.
Right. Henry III just can't get away with what his father, King John, got away with. And it's the fine rolls which show that. Mm. Plus, I should say that we've made a terrific effort in the project to sort of get these themes across, because the website's not merely got the actual text of the rolls, but it's all, and the images, but it's also got a lot of comment. And one thing we're particularly proud of is the Fine of the Month feature, in which every month a member of the project team or someone outside the project has commented on material on the rolls. And they started in December 2005. There are now 66 of them. I'm afraid we haven't done one for June yet, but it's going to be about Henry III's sense of humour. And anyone outside the project is encouraged to send one in. And in fact, the Fine of the Month last year, which won the Fine of the Year prize, was done by the villagers of Nunney in Somerset, who simply found on the fine rolls the date of the very first market charter which Nunney had. So you, Dave, you must have a look and see if you can contribute a fine of the month, or get all your team at the BBC History magazine to compulsorily contribute a fine of the month.
It's quite a challenge, and maybe I'll take it up. But let's just go back to, you mentioned Henry III, and you mentioned Henry III's sense of humour just then as possibly the fine of the month. So can you learn a lot about Henry III himself?
Yeah, I think you can. I think you can learn a great deal about the personality of the king, because these fine royals, although they're becoming increasingly governmental and bureaucratic, are still very, very personal to the king. And I mean, just take the example of the sense of humour, which we know from the fine royals. And this is in Henry III's ship, when coming back from expedition to Gascony in 1243. And he actually records a joke or a tease on the fine royals. And what the fine royal entry says is Henry III having a joke against his, or with his clerk, Peter the Poitevin, ordered all these extraordinary debts which Peter the Poitevin had incurred to be written down on the fine rolls. So it says, Peter the Poitevin has owes the king 100 marks for a foolish remark he made on the ship. Peter the Poitevin owes the king 20 chickens because he missold some of the king's wines. And this great list of hilarious, jocular penalties, fines, which Peter the Poitevin has incurred, are sort of written down. And then what it says is, when Peter the Poitevin is not looking, cross them all out, because Henry didn't want him to get into trouble. Because clearly the idea was that Peter the Poitevin would sort of look at the fine and think, oh my God, what's going on? Why on, how on earth am I incurred all these penalties? And everyone will stand around sort of laughing at him when he sees this. So that's the sort of slightly genteel sense of humour. John's sense of humour was far more unpleasant in a way, and that's also on the fine rolls, because it's on the fine rolls that you get the extraordinary fine in which the wife of Hugh de Neville offers King John 200 chickens so she can sleep one night with her husband. And it's very hard to interpret, but I think what it must be is that the wife of Hugh de Neville is John's mistress, and John and she are sort of having a joke together and saying, what's it worth to spend one night back with Hugh, your husband? And so she says a rather ridiculous thing, well, I'll give you 200 chickens. And John has this recorded on the fine rolls. No wonder Hugh de Neville later rebelled against him.
So it's funny, isn't it? You can see the character of these kings coming through.
You can.
He's otherwise perhaps fairly dry documents, you would have thought.
Oh, yes, you can. You can see the king's anger. I mean, Henry III often seems very benign, but you can get quite brutal fines when people are, even under Henry III, having to offer large sums of money to recover the king's favour. There's one from John de Balliol in 1257, in which he offers £500 that the king should forgive the rancour he had towards him for mistreating Henry's daughter, who was the Queen of Scotland, things like that. So it shows both the king's anger, his sense of humour, all sorts of things like that.
And Henry suffers a bit, I think, you may disagree, from being sandwiched between two perhaps more famous kings, John and Edward. And is this going to bring him alive a bit more?
I hope it will. I mean, you're quite right. Wherever I go, I have to start off by saying, who was Henry III? And I often place him by saying, well, he's the son of King John, because everyone's heard of King John. I hope this will. I hope that it will make Henry emerge in all his benevolence, in a way, his occasional anger, his sense of humour. He was fundamentally, I think, a very pious, decent man. And of course, what I think it will also do is more widely put Henry on the map for his greatest achievement, which was, of course, to build Westminster Abbey. And, I mean, I hope that the recent royal wedding has actually put Henry back on the map a bit, because I've certainly done a lot of interviews for it, and the first thing I always say is, you know, this great church in which this royal wedding is taking place, in which we see so splendidly set out in the television pictures, why is it there? Who built it? Henry III built it entirely at his own expense, and he built it to create the most magnificent church in the world. And the fine rolls throw light on that, because Henry is often diverting money from fines to the fabric fund of Westminster Abbey.
Finally, the project's coming to a close. We're having the conference now, which is the closing episode. Is that it? You done?
Well, it's not quite it, because actually the conference doesn't finish, the project doesn't finish till the end of the year.
Indeed.
But we thought this was a good time for the conference. And I think we're going to keep the Find of the Month feature going sort of for as long as we can have contributions to it. So it'll go on, and we'll be correcting the roles and updating them
I think. But it's on to the next project. Mm-hmm. And I hope we may be doing one, a collaborative one, or I'll be involved in a collaborative one, about Magna Carta itself for the anniversary in 2015. Mm. It hasn't got funding yet, so we're waiting in bated breath to see what happens.
So the website for that project once more is www.finerollshenryfree.org.uk, and it's a great place to have a mooch around. David Carpenter mentioned the construction of Westminster Abbey as Henry III's greatest achievement, and it's no surprise to note that he nominated the Abbey in the recently published BBC History magazine book, 100 Places That Made Britain. You can read an edited version of the piece on our website at historyextra.com/visit/Westminster-Abbey-London, or buy the book from any good bookseller for the full story. Now, we'd really like to hear more from you or about what you think about the podcast, so we've got an email address that you can send in your thoughts to, and that's podcast@historyextra.com, or you can call the voicemail number that we've set up. The number is a UK number, 01172302002. UK landline callers will pay local rate. Overseas charges and charges from other operators may vary. I just thought I'd mention one email that we've had in, which is from Beatrice from Norway, and she says, "I was thrilled to hear that you are now going to be weekly. I think it's much better with four shorter podcasts of 30 minutes length than the 1 hour one once a month. I really like to listen to history programs, especially yours, since you always have different historic subjects in each podcast. So it's always something I found interesting. The only suggestion I have is that you could perhaps try to have a competition, and the prize should of course be some excellent BBC History magazines." So thank you, Beatrice. Kind words. Any other suggestions about ways we could improve the podcast, competition or otherwise, would be most welcome. So do please get in touch, either by email or by our voicemail, or just contact us via Twitter or Facebook. That's it for this week. Just a reminder that the website for our new Tudor audiobook, distributed by audiogo.co.uk, is www.historyextra.com/audiobooks/Tudors, a snip at just £1.99. And I should just mention that the August issue of the magazine proper, which is the Tudor special, is on sale in the UK on Tuesday, the 19th of July. Next week, we have Professor George Bernard on one of the big names in Tudor history, King Henry VIII, plus Professor Justin Champion of Royal Holloway, University of London, on Thomas Hobbes. I do hope you'll listen in.